From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life.
I'm Pete Stoughton.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Whether your mental or physical wellness brings you to the top of the highest peaks,
or you need a little help with the climb,
The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Our first interview is pre-recorded by Lynn with Dr. Blythe Grossberg, who wrote a captivating memoir about tutoring for Manhattan's elite, revealing how a life of extreme wealth both helps and harms the children of the 1%. Her new book is I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. We hope you enjoy this interview.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's good to be here.
Your book, wow. It's so interesting. On the one hand, it's this intense parenting pressure, high stakes parenting. On the other hand, it's sort of naive cluelessness. How can both, how do they coexist?
Well, I think what I found is that a lot of parents in the top, economic echelon really exist in a kind of bubble. So I think that's where the kind of clueless factor comes in, because they're just not exposed that much, or don't expose themselves to, the kind of larger reality of the way a lot of people live.
Yeah. And this attitude of stopping at nothing to create a successful child, haven't we all seen enough book covers when we're in an airport bookstore that talk about raising resilient children? There seems to be a real disconnect. And I'm just wondering, for you as a tutor of these kids, how much that surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, I think experts have been talking about, the blessing of a skid knee is another great title out there. Have been talking about allowing kids to fail for quite some time, and, kind of warning/advising parents to let their kids fail and learn from their failures in controlled ways. But I think it's really hard for parents to follow that advice. And what I write about in the book is that, even these parents at the top, economic echelons of the country are very fearful. In fact, they seem more fearful in a way of losing status or falling from their high status. So, I think they know on one hand that they should allow their kids to fail, but it's this fear that motivates them not to allow their kids to fail.
Isn't that interesting how we are all very often motivated by fear of what we'll lose, and yet these parents have gained so much in their lives. It on the one hand, they've gained so much, but as we know, operating out of fear is not a happy place to be as well. I'm wondering if you can just go back to, first of all, you're a Harvard graduate. So to a certain degree, I mean, you were raised in this milieu, you were raised in this world where competition and academic success was forefront. Talk a little bit about how you were raised.
I think I'm old enough that I wasn't, subject to some of the forces that kids are subjected to today, who in particular come from these affluent schools, whether they're private or public, across the country. I grew up in rural Massachusetts in the 70s and 80s. It really didn't have the same feel that, it has today. For example, I tell the story in the book about how I took the SAT one day, and it was kind of like the day before, my friends and I all gathered around and said, oh, we're taking that test tomorrow, and we just headed to the test, and it was like a beautiful Saturday in New England. And, the main thing was, where are we going to gather for the party after the test? And, no one really took it that seriously. And I think that was also the parents. We had parents who were not really, they're obviously not Gen Xers, but in a way, some of them weren't even baby boomers when I was growing up. And my parents are in the first year of the baby boom, or even before the baby boom. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it was just a really different atmosphere. And, you know, I went to Harvard in part because it was easier to get into in those days, but also because I just loved learning so much and it was really genuine. And I wasn't really kind of calculating how I was going to get a great job after Harvard. In fact, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So, you know, I just think the pressures 30 years ago were really different than today.
Right. Well, you first started as a tutor and a learning specialist. And how did you decide, you know, what your market was? I mean, you didn't really start off thinking you'd be in the high-end apartments of Fifth Avenue.
No, I just kind of fell into it because I was living in New York City. And, you know, at first I attended graduate school and just needed some extra money to like get through graduate school. And then I started working at a private school, and a person at another private school who I knew invited me to tutor one of the students that he was working with. So that's kind of all how it happened. And, you know, as I described in the book, I really felt that this world was pretty alien to me at mm-hmm. first, even though, you know, I'm from the Northeast, I'm from a privileged background and everything. But even so, I wasn't really prepared for the kind of wealth and privilege and just kind of the interesting ways that the 0.01% live and raise their children.
You talk about how Ben orders daily room service while living in a 5-star hotel. Olivia mm-hmm. collects luxury brand sneakers worn by celebrities. Dakota jets off to Rome when she needs to avoid drama at school. And then the title of your book, I Left My Homework in the Hamptons. Which I'm sure that happened.
Well, you know, that really was an excuse that yes. Some students used when I was a teacher. And they said, you know, Dr. Grossberg, we don't have our homework. And, you know, this was the days before Google Docs, so they couldn't, like, transport their, you know, documents with them on their computer. So they claimed that they had left their homework on another document on another computer. You know, that was left in their luxury summer resort house in the Hamptons. And that, and, you know, I sort of looked at them and I said, wait a minute. So you want an excuse for not handing in your homework because you have two homes while the rest of us don't have that excuse. And it didn't really occur to them to think of things that way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that surprised me, I had no idea what it cost to hire a tutor on Fifth Avenue. I think I read you like to keep your rates between $125 and $175 an hour. Well,
yes.
Some tutoring services will charge between $300 and $800 an hour. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I'm sure, Lynn, that the price, because now I live in Massachusetts again, but I'm sure the price has, you know, in Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn has only climbed since then. So it's probably over $800 an hour. And that's kind of mainly for SAT and ACT tutoring. And there are these boutique luxury tutoring companies that charge that much money. And part of how they get results is that they just ask the kids to do a lot of practice tests. So every weekend, the kids are sitting down, you know, who are in 11th grade and taking full-length practice tests. And the problem with that is it starts to erode their schoolwork and it starts to make them pretty stressed out and anxious. You know, and the parent, and, you know, a lot of the companies and the parents will require kids to take the SAT or ACT again and again until they get the scores, if they can get the scores that they want. Mm-hmm. So these tutoring companies, I think, are not, you know, they're really motivated more by business than they are by education.
Right. The business of getting into a good college. Ah, wow. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, my guest is Blythe Grossberg. Her new book is called I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. Park City is quite an affluent place, becoming more and more so that way. And the number one issue that if you talk to the kids at the high school and, you know, and even throughout their education here in Park City, the number one sort of issue and challenge and complaint is the stress of being perfect. Mm-hmm. And this comes, you know, this comes with affluence, and it's a big thing to be saddled with for a child. And it leads to, you know, it can lead, if some kids rise, you know, to the top, the quote unquote top, and they can handle it and they thrive with that kind of stress. Other kids just cannot. What were some of the side effects that you would see from some of these children?
Yeah, so Lynn, that's what I really tried to capture with some of the profiles of students in my book. And, you know, I found a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, substance abuse of various kinds. And I talk about one student who really wasn't well suited for her school in that she attended a pretty prestigious, very demanding private school. And she had what we call either learning disabilities or learning differences, and it made it really hard for her. But her parents really were invested, literally, in keeping her in the school. So, you know, it really began to take a toll on her. And her parents were often, you know, they were around, but when they were around, they were often putting a lot of pressure on her. So, you know, she wound up shoplifting some items from a pretty high-priced Manhattan department store and, you know, was arrested and had to go before a judge and do public service and all that kind of thing. And, you know, it's just kind of ironic that a person who has everything would decide to shoplift. And it wasn't really for the goods, obviously. It was really just to get attention, and it was sort of a cry for help. So, you know, the research, and I cite this in the book, research has found that now attending an affluent school, which could be an affluent, you know, a public school in an affluent area, is actually a pretty strong risk factor for developing depression, anxiety, substance abuse problems, and other issues.
And yet, you know, the really sad thing about this, I think the one that you're talking about was Sophie or Sophia.
Yes, Sophie,
Yeah, of course, you changed all the names. But yes. But Sophie could have benefited by your services so much because she had the learning disability and she had the issues, and yet her parents tried to hide those. And, you know, your help could have really helped her. You know, instead, you know, it turns into something that is really only further handicapping her, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of a kid's success is having skills, but part of it is, you know, being in the right school or the right classes and having the right kinds of teachers. So, you know, there's a huge difference between attending a kind of traditional school versus a school that's, you know, set up for kids who learn differently. And it doesn't, you know, it's not a mark of their intelligence. There are a lot of really smart people who learn differently than others, whether they have dyslexia or ADD or whatever it is. But they need to be in an environment as kids where the teachers really know how to reach them and know how to teach to their strengths rather than always kind of requiring them to do things that they're not particularly good at. So, you know, for example, I think like a special ed type of school would have, you know, asked Sophie if she read a book to maybe, you know, do an art project based on it. And, you know, I don't mean to say that special ed schools aren't stringent, because they are, but I think they allow kids to demonstrate what they know in different ways. And, you know, that can be really great for a kid's self-esteem and, you know, for feeling like they're not dumb, But, you know, I think when kids attend these really, really stressful competitive schools, whether they're public or private, they do feel like they're not measuring up, as you said. And it's almost impossible for everyone to measure up, you know, in the ways that are expected of them.
Right, right. You know, I always have this question. I mean, is it that there are just so many more children out there and only so many Ivy League schools? You know, if you're looking at the time that you were applying to Harvard, for example, that it was much less competitive. Is it that somehow the Ivy Leagues have captured us, or, you know, or the, you know, let's just talk about not just Ivy Leagues, but, you know, good schools in general have captured us and we've started to focus on that more, or is it just the sheer numbers?
It's both. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, the applicant pool in most years, you know, not during the pandemic, but otherwise the applicant pool tends to be international in nature. So, you know, applicants from the United States are facing even more competition and, you know, pressure to get in. In addition, I think affluent parents have really decided to kind of focus on the brand names of colleges. So, you know, they want to purchase this kind of education for their kids, you know, and they really concentrate on brand names like those in the Ivy League. Whereas in reality, you know, kids, college students can get a good education in so many state schools and lesser known colleges and universities. So, you know, I think it's partly the desire of the parents to really, again, you know, believe that all the kids are, you know, above average, as Garrison Keillor said, and, you know, purchase something that's really almost like a brand name item for their children.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm speaking with Blythe Grossberg. Her new book is I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%. You know, so often I think teachers would love to be able to just, educators in general would love to be able to say to the parents, this one thing, what is that one thing for you that you're not able to say?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's so many things I want to say, Lynn. It's hard to pick just one thing. I don't know. I mean, I think there, if I could just pick a few things, one of the things would be, you know, give your kids some time. It's very hard today because I think, you know, it's competitive. I think parenting is very competitive. And some kids are just on a slightly different or very different trajectory than other kids, but it doesn't mean that they won't get there or they won't get where they want to go eventually. And, you know, it's hard, I think, when we're so stressed as parents to really see that, because we just, you know, naturally start comparing our kids to other kids. But we really have to find out who our kids are and what's important to them and what their talents are. And, you know, I found in the families I worked with, because they were very affluent, they really wanted their kids to follow in their mold and, you know, work in banking or technology or, you know, corporate law. And that may or may not have been what the kids wanted or were good at. So I think that's one thing. And then I think the other thing that a lot of teachers want to tell parents is that we're all working for the kids together. So I think, you know, sometimes parents get stressed and they come into teachers' offices and, you know, start kind of making accusations and being very defensive. And it's, I acknowledge it's really hard as a parent not to feel defensive, but if possible, you know, try to remind yourself as parents that most teachers are in the profession because they really want to help kids, not because they're time servers and not because they want to torture people. And, you know, I think sometimes we forget that we can like work together as parents and teachers.
Those are all really good points. You know, there's an uptick of diagnoses of learning disabilities and things like ADHD and you know, disorders along the autism spectrum and things like that. And I'm just wondering how that affects this whole world when really, you know, again, like going back to Sophie, there's so much help that is available out there, especially for the 1%. But how is that affecting this world of academic success when we're seeing more and more of these disorders, along with anxiety and depression?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I think to some degree, some of these things are what I would call overdiagnosed among very affluent people, because they're really looking for any little quirk in a kid's learning style that might explain why they're not, you know, straight A plus students. So some parents kind of tend to, I think, scrutinize their kids' records a little bit too much and then, you know, bring them to be evaluated. And I think, you know, when any one of us went, you know, if any one of us underwent an evaluation, we would find something we weren't so good at. So, you know, so to some degree, I think, you know, this 0.1% in particular has overdiagnosed some of these issues, whereas people without means who don't have access to private evaluators, who attend public schools where there are so many students, they can't even, you know, get their student evaluated in a timely way. You know, I think for them, these issues are underdiagnosed. But among the people I write about, it tends to be, you know, a greater awareness of learning issues, which is really good. But I was always in the situation where some people, you know, thought their kids had these major, major issues when they really didn't. And then some kids who really needed to be evaluated, their parents, you know, as you discussed with Sophie, just kind of didn't want to admit that their kids had these learning differences. So, you know, I kind of think both things are true.
Right. You know, we've talked a lot about sort of the drawbacks of being in this world, I guess, or the byproducts that aren't necessarily positive, but there must be, you know, a lot of positivity. You know, money doesn't bring you everything, but it brings you a lot of opportunity, let's say. And so I wanted to end on a positive note and, you know, again, with advice from someone like you, you know, how you would steer this towards real positivity.
Yeah, I mean, I was very excited about the education these kids were getting. I thought it was amazing. I mean, I wished I had had that education in high school, which I didn't really. You know, I got really excited for them. The books they read, you know, the places they visited, the speakers who were, you know, world renowned in their fields who would come to their schools. So I think, you know, there's a lot of really good things going on at their schools. You know, I think money is not bad in itself, but it was just that the money in their case was not used to further, you know, their goals or dreams as kids. And it certainly didn't always create happiness.
Right. And finally, Blythe, what are you doing now in your career?
Well, now I live in Boston and still work in a school, but I decided to leave New York. New York is, you know, a difficult city to live in. And, you know, it's really honestly a city where I think teachers have a hard time, or anybody who's not in the 1% really has a hard time finding somewhere to live. And, you know, you might be experiencing the same thing out where you live, but, you know, it's hard. And, you know, there tends to be this sort of concentration of the 0.1% in Manhattan. So, for all these reasons, I left New York and returned to my native haunts in Massachusetts.
Well, not a bad place. I love Boston and Massachusetts in general. Okay, before I let you go, I just want one question, because you've written so many books on autism and Asperger's, and I'm wondering, you know, I've heard so much recently about how these disorders can be diagnosed so early. I read one bit of research about how even as early as like 3 months old, You could see by the way that the baby would track, their vision would sort of track, that would be an indicator. And I'm just wondering about this early diagnosis of autism, and if you're seeing, you know, parents, you know, we did just talk about overdiagnoses, but these are really good things to be aware of early. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. You know, I think even if we can't make a conclusive diagnosis of a baby who's 3 or 6 months old, if we see these problematic signs, the research points to, you know, getting help really early, and, you know, getting help earlier rather than later has a really beneficial effect. So my own son, as I discuss in the book, is on the autism spectrum. And, you know, he's 16 now. When he was little, it was a little bit, you know, the diagnosis was a little bit slower. But I really see that, you know, he worked a lot with speech and language therapists and other kinds of professionals and teachers. And I really think it helped him. So, you know, there's no reason to delay if you're a parent to, you know, checking in with even your primary care or your family doctor and just asking their, you know, advice or opinion, because getting help early is so beneficial.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. The book is I Left My Homework in the Hamptons, What I Learned Teaching the Children of the 1%, my guest, Dr. Blythe Grossberg. Thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life. This is a fascinating book, really, and your experience and just your background in education overall really rich, makes it a very rich read. So thank you. I have a feeling we'll be having a lot of parents from Park City ordering your book.
Well, thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate your having me here.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Mountain Life.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you subscribe, rate us, and leave us a comment.
If you have an idea for a future show, email us at mountainlife@kpcw.org.
We hope you'll bring your green smoothie and join us next week for The Mountain Life.